This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on September 19, 2012. Tonight we're talking to Matt Rock. And Matt is, well, Matt, I first stumbled across your name when I started reading about Request Reduce, but then I've been reading your blog and you're into all kinds of things, so I'm really looking forward to this. And we were just talking about a few things before the call. One is that you had been listening to the show for a while and that we both started at Microsoft basically the same day, which is funny. So can you give us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I've been in this industry in a paid format for about 13 years. Most of that time was actually in Southern California doing basically an online advertising. So I spent a lot of time, I built out a display advertising network, and then I eventually moved to domain parking. So, you know, all the good things of the internet.
Right.
And so eventually I worked my way to, you know, I found myself a VP of technology, doing less and less technology and more managing. And, you know, I think, you know, managers are very important. There's a place for managers, but I didn't feel like I was losing the sense of doing something that I loved. And despite, you know, stock options, which is basically what kind of kept me there, and I'm glad I left now because now they're all gone. But so I moved to Microsoft to, you know, do real engineering, stoked that I got the job, and it landed up in a sister team of CodePlex. So I got exposed, you know, I had always been exposed, but got really exposed to people kind of in the open source world. And, you know, people on my team at the time, I was a tech lead of the Visual Studio Gallery. That's what it's most known for, but basically we did all sorts of galleries, and really wanted to start my own open source project. Just seemed like that would be a cool thing to do, and was thinking, you know, what could I do that would be cool that nobody else is doing or nobody else is doing quite right. And so one day I was on a run, and it just kind of, I don't know, just all of a sudden hit me image spriting and you know, JavaScript, CSS, you know, minification and compression, but with a different twist. And, you know, we can get into that, the details of that later, but that was Request Reduce. That was around March of 2010. And I think it finally went, you know, I actually had something that late that summer. And then recently I've been really into kind of build automation type of stuff, which has led me to Chocolaty, and been doing a lot of stuff with, I want to be able to have a computer go from a bare OS to completely what I want it with, you know, one line of code. And so that's what I'm working on now.
So for Request Reduce, you said it's got a different twist to it. The main thing that I picked up about it is there are a lot of things out there that you can use. Like there's ASP.NET bundling minification. There was Ajax minifier. There's a lot of minification systems out there. What I picked up from looking at Request Reduce is it's really kind of a drop-in, so you can use it with legacy brownfield kind of applications, right?
Exactly. It's really kind of it was meant to be a plug and play type of a system. And it's funny, you know, I hear from people, like I've heard from people that use it with classic ASP. I've heard from a guy that uses it with PHP. So he's got, you know, PHP running off of fast CGI on IIS. I just think, you know, that's pretty awesome. But obviously, you know, the common use cases are just a typical, you know, not necessarily legacy. Though I think that is a good niche for it. So yes, the thing that differentiates Request Reduce from, you know, the popular ones, I think today probably I'd say the most popular ones are the one that comes with ASP.NET now, and then a Cassette, which is a great product. I've gotten to know Andy Davies, great guy, great product. So I just want to, you know, say if you haven't checked out getcassette.net and you want something that plays, you know, more like a traditional minifier, look at that. And in fact, he just recently pulled in some of my spriting code. So the main inspiration and the thing that really kind of hit me was that, you know, everything that these things do, minification, spriting, none of it is incredibly, some of the spriting can get pretty complicated, but none of it's incredibly complicated. It's all fairly tedious work and really follows kind of this this basic decision tree of, okay, have you done this? Have you done that? Have you done this? Have you done that? And so it really requires something to just know what the rules are that you want your site to play by, and make sure that you do it correctly. And just, stupid stuff. Like, I remember once I think I misspelled, the cache control header. And so for a month, I didn't know it, but, my stuff wasn't being cached. And, so just little things like that. So it seemed to me that, can't you just look at the page and kind of make some decisions and do some of these things without any interaction? Because, I think recently website performance has become a huge topic, and it's kind of cool. It's been making mainstream news, especially around the holidays. And so it has it's one of those things that has an impact on a company's bottom line. But you ask your developers, okay, we've got a whole bunch of new images out. Who wants to sprite the images? No one's going to raise their hands. It's just a lot of tedious work. And so it occurred to me that most of this could be automated. Now, interesting enough, so most of my personal background, it's been on the web. It's been back end. So a lot of database. And I have never been, I've always been, capable of getting in there and messing with the CSS, but I would never have called myself a CSS guru. So there were certain principles or technicalities about CSS that at the time when I was thinking this up, I just didn't know. So like a lot of things that I think of, they end up being a lot more difficult than I originally thought they would be. especially when I got into some of the image optimization, that got pretty, at least for me, it got pretty doggone complicated.
Hey, Matt, could you tell people how this works a little bit about the architecture? Does it happen at build time or runtime?
Sure. Yeah. So in terms of what you have to do at a minimum, there's all sorts of configuration, but at a minimum, you take this, you download it through NuGet and you're set to go. Now that assumes you're working on a single server site. So we'll just stick with that simplicity for now. So essentially what happens is, this DLL, it's a DLL that's living in your bin. It's about three lines of web config code. And the main hook that it uses to consume your site's content is a response filter. So basically what that is you've got, typically the way that you hook that up is through like an HTTP module where you just basically say, sometime early on in the life cycle of the page, you say, okay, the stream that you send out to the internet, send it to me, let me have a look at it, and then I'm going to, forward it on. And you can, the way response filters work, that you can chain them. So you can have, several response filters conceivably, and they each just kind of pass the response on to another. So it comes to, the content comes to me as simply a byte stream. So what happens is when, let's say the first user comes to your site and the content of that site gets streamed out through me. What I do is I'm first looking for certain tokens. So I'm looking for, tokens that will show me, this is a CSS link or this is a script tag. So as the stream is going through, I'm putting these tokens together and I'm forming what I call CSS or JavaScript signatures. And what I mean by that is it's essentially, if I see, let's say, five CSS tags that are contiguous meaning nothing other than comments or white space in between, I consider that a signature. So the signature being all the URLs that are associated with those, I put together and I make a hash out of that. And so as the content's going out, I grab that hash and I basically look inside of an in-memory data structure that I have that just says, okay, do I have something for this hash? If I don't, I take that hash and I put it in a queue. And I just forward the content on as is. So when you first fire up your servers, the first few requests may not get any kind of alteration.
But on the bright side, there's no slowdown, right? It's all kind of done on the background.
So because this is a very expensive process perf-wise. So then what happens? So like I say, it puts it in a queue. So I have a single background thread that is basically looking for new items in the queue. And so as items come up in that queue, it grabs it. And so let's say this could be maybe a string of CSS tags. It could be a string of JavaScript tags. It could be a single JavaScript tag. So it takes them. And let's say it's a string of CSS tags. So basically, it takes each URL that's in the CSS tag and actually goes out, you know, over the internet. I'm assuming that you're, I mean, it might end up being just locally, but you know, wherever that URL points to is going to get the content. And that's one thing that differentiates this from other systems, where a lot of systems are more file based, where you tell it, okay, these are the files, this is the directory that you'll find it in. So this can be, you know, this can be remote, which brings in some nice situations with like using CDNs. But
I thought that was interesting from looking at the code. So it's using a web client and doing a remote request. So if you're pulling in images or CSS, like you're saying, from CDN or wherever, Twitter Bootstrap hosted somewhere or whatever, like it's going to pull that in.
Right. So it pulls it in. So, you know, the CSS processing is definitely the most complicated. So, you know, and all this stuff, you know, there's different things that you can turn on and turn off. The simplest thing, honestly, is the minification. And I actually use the AJAX minifier to do the minification. So I'll merge that in. So, and I also just want to say that I think his name is Ron Logan, the guy that runs AJAX Min. That guy is just amazingly responsive. So I've had, you know, this is some of the great things about open source that you just can't do inside of a, you know, a big company, is I'll have days where, you know, a user reports a bug. The bug is actually related to AJAX Min. I fill a ticket with the AJAX minifier. He pushes a fix that day. You know, I get a fix that day, and then the person using it can push their fix that day. So, and you know, I've also made a point of, you know, automating everything. So I'm working on this by myself. I need to make sure that, you know, every single piece in the process can be done as quickly and reliably as possible. But so at any rate, it's fairly obvious what happens in the minification and the crunching. Some interesting things with the CSS is it also minifies imports. So if you could have a CSS that imports another CSS that imports another CSS, and they'll expand all that out. And believe me, I've seen some sites that just, I mean, at the end of the day, they're making, I'm not going to say what site this is, but it's their site, and they were making 20, 30 CSS calls before request reduce and about 5 or 6 afterwards. By far and away, the most complicated part is the image spriting. So when I started this, the whole notion, I'll explain this, the whole notion of a viewport, I wasn't fully aware of how that worked with CSS. And we're talking CSS. So we're talking CSS 2. So I, you know, one of the things about with request reduce I've tried to make it, and I've gotten broader and broader and broader. You know, eventually I pulled in ASP.NET 3.5, which, you know, now that we're at 4.5, I'm going to probably pay a lot less attention to that. But I definitely, at the time that I put this out, it needed to be CSS 2.0, you know, it clearly needed to be CSS 2.0 compliant. And even today, it needs to be that. This is, so just, you know, like I mentioned, I until recently, I was tech lead on the Microsoft Galleries platform. So we did Visual Studio Gallery, the Microsoft Samples Gallery. I also did a lot of work on like Microsoft Forums. So these were the type of sites that I wanted to put it on. And I was fortunate enough where I had the ability to do this. I treated this as a moonlighting project. And so I needed to support, you know, IE 7, IE 8, which, you know, honestly, if I could have not supported those two browsers, there could have been things could have been a lot easier. So the tricky part is finding out essentially where one CSS sprite image begins and ends. And one of the things that request reduce does require is that it at least has to be able to figure out what the width is of the space in which the image will fill. The reason why that is let's say I don't know what that width is, but there's a background image there. And one might say, oh, well, the background image is 20 pixels. So, you know, 20 pixels is how wide you're going to be. Well, the problem is that, you know, with divs and things like that, that can, you know, expand and move, it could be that that image is 20 pixels, but for whatever reason, you know, the way that the user has their browser expanded or, you know, whatever. Yeah, I mean, and believe me, I've seen some crazy stuff where people have half a meg images, you know, filling some small, you know, tiny part up.
Right.
So if I just smack that in there and there's no width, that image runs the risk of bleeding out you know, beyond that, you know, what's called the usually called the viewport, basically being the space of the screen that is intended to render the image. It is considered a best practice to you know, to include the dimensions of your background images, but to be honest, you know, I'd say maybe a majority, maybe not, but a lot of people don't. But if I can't make out the width, I don't sprite it. I've heard of other people that will say, well, if I don't know what the width is, I'll pad it with like 200 pixels. So, you know, there's the obvious limitation that, you know, maybe 200 pixels isn't enough. The other problem that you run there is, even if you pad it, and I'm talking padding it with transparency, so mm-hmm. Think that that wouldn't have any effect, but it actually does. That the more space that if you had a 20 by 20 image, but you padded it with 1,000 by 1,000 pixels, you know, even if they're transparent, that consumes up memory space on the browser. So it can actually have a performance impact on the browser. And so then beyond that is the actual compression of the image. So very common on, you know, some sites is not to do the type, you know, not to do compression like you should be doing. So, you know, a lot of people are getting better at this, but honestly, you know, you should be putting your images through some kind of a product like, oh, there's, you know, there's tons of them out there.
Like Pingout or whatever.
Which actually, Request Reduce uses, what is it? It's PNG. That might be that one. Name fails me at the minute, but there's two interesting things that happen with image optimization that can have absolutely dramatic effects. You know, so as you know, there's all sorts of different types of images. There's PNGs, there's, you know, GIFs and JPEGs. And with PNGs, which are typically what you want to use unless you're dealing with photographs, there's all sorts of different types of, you know, so you've got 8-bit PNGs, you've got 24-bit PNGs, and you've got 32-bit PNGs. And try not to get too obscure here, but basically the big, what you want, if you can, you want 8-bit PNGs because they essentially consume about a fourth of the memory that a 32-bit PNG. The problem is that they don't have as many colors. So you're basically limited to a 255 color palette. So there's this process that's known as quantization, where you take a image that might be thousands of colors and reduce that down to 255 colors. And what's interesting is that in many cases, the human eye can't tell the difference, especially on the web and with smaller images. So there's, you know, I heard one rule of thumb out there. This was at one of a Velocity conference talk, that if you have less than, if you have 5,000 colors or less, you should be able to shrink that down to an 8-bit PNG of 255 colors without, typically, you know, just as a rule of thumb, without noticeably distorting the quality. So, you know, I had known about this. I was doing some of this. I was using some external tools to do this. So there's the quantization, and then there's compression. And the compression is basically, there's all sorts of different ways in a PNG that you can compress it. There's the PNG format can take, I forget, for each row, and it can actually use a different compression algorithm. And so what a lot of these compression tools, like I think it's called PNG Out, what they do is essentially they iterate over
just those. So I looked up, I got Reflector open here. You got, I think you're using OptiPing, OptiPing.
Yeah, another, yeah, very, very popular one.
Okay.
So anyways, what they do is they iterate the rows and they look for kind of the ideal compression algorithm. They're doing some other stuff too, you know, that's one of the things that they do. And the problem is that there's no good .NET port for that, which is why I use OptiPing. And that was another project that I'd love to do someday, but, you know, I have limited time because, I mean, it's definitely doable is to write a .NET compressor. It's just, you know, it's tedious code. You know, nobody likes to write that, but that's one of the hardest things I've ever done. I don't have a math background, so that definitely stretched that. But the nice thing is, like you mentioned, is that this can take 2-3 seconds to do, and that's typically fine.
Right. So, I mean, you're able to do things the right way since you're doing everything queued, everything's on a background thread, like it's for the second request for that page. You're able to do things the right way.
Right, exactly. You know, I mean, in the you know, there's always the, you know, what's super fast and what's good enough. You know, in most of the cases that Request Reduce runs on, you know, your typical, you know, unless you have a ton of images, you can most pages get transformed within a, you know, within a second, and that's a one-time deal. So when you go live with a new image or a new set of CSS, I mean, that happens once at server startup, and even it can even persist, you know, server, you know, reboots. So it really is a one-time deal until you push out new content, which is the main one of the key problems, pain points with Request Reduce is making sure that content gets refreshed when it's supposed to. So like I mentioned before, what it does is it's looking for this hash. And the way it knows if something is different is basically if it just doesn't see that hash anymore. And that hash is based on the URL. So, you know, a lot of people, and, you know, I've done this myself. If you have a CSS that you call, I don't know, you know, style.css, and you don't do anything with a path or the query string or anything to change it, you change some content, you put out a new style.css, well, Request Reduce doesn't know it's a new style.css. You know, it's not going to pop open every single file that it comes across. So, you know, again, it is a best practice. And, you know, hopefully most people are doing this, but, you know, then there's reality. To, you know, to somehow version your URLs, you know, to put something in there that, you know, makes the URL change when a new version comes out. If you're doing that, then that works great, and Request Reduce will, you know, should very quickly reprocess that. But if you don't have that, and a lot of people do, and sometimes, you know, it's one of those things that sounds, oh, it's just version your URL. You know, how difficult can that be? But, you know, most big sites are built on top of some kind of framework that you don't just go in and just like flip the URL versioning switch, you know?
Right. So I used to work for a very popular network appliance manufacturing firm that's located in Seattle, without giving away any names. But they made a product that sat in front of their firewall / application delivery controller / router that would do some of the kind of optimizations. So in other words, if you had five or six n number of requests on a page for static items like PNGs, images, script files, CSS, it would actually create fake top or third level domains so that it could get around the two domain requests at a time limitation that is supposedly in the spec. And it would also do things like automatically version those and cache them as well, so that the next client that would come along and request those, as long as it wasn't over like a secure connection, it would go straight to the cache instead of even going back to the origin server. So it kind of acted like an edge network, like Akamai, but very localized and personalized. But one of the things that we had looked at doing was on the fly was seeing if we could find all the image tags and convert the paths into data URI, base64 encoded values, so that we wouldn't even have to send the binary data across or even cache that. We would just, you know, we convert the PNG and then cache the base64 encoding and send that across so that we'd get the benefits of the gzip compression as well going outward. And I was wondering if you had looked into any of that for Request Reduce.
I have. Yeah, that's interesting. There's some really interesting things that you can do. Not only can you do that, but I read a blog post. I wish I could remember the guy's name, but he talked about you can basically, you know, create fonts. So you like GitHub's a good example where they've got like all these small little images, and they basically have created. I think they did this, but I know that you can do this. You can basically create your own font, and then that brings in its own kind of nice caching stories as well. You know, it's one of those things where sometimes it's so you can't just say, oh, we'll just make base64 everything, you know, everything. I mean, you figure if that was the case, then, you know, everybody would be doing that. At the same time, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I know the you know, all the parameters that would be pro and con. I know I've looked into it. And I know that certainly that Request Reduce, what I'd love to see in a future version is taking advantage of some of that, because it certainly does solve some problems. It brings in some interesting cross-browser situations, which is another, you know, kind of a general interesting topic just with request reduce in general, is some, there are, you know, lots of cross-browser issues, but I forget, I think it's IE7. I think IE7 has a hard time with, or just doesn't play well with Base64. Honestly, at least in my mind, we're getting pretty close to moonlighting IE7. But you know, I mean, there's some people out there that are pretty adamant about supporting IE6. So, I think there's some cool things that you can do. Now, one thing you mentioned, the appliance, and that's really kind of cool. And there's some cool companies that are doing neat stuff with their, like Strange Loop and what's the other big one? I forget. But Request Reduce does do some, you know, when I say it doesn't, you know, so it relies on the user to version their URL to refresh it. But once Request Reduce gets a hold of that image, it does version it. So it hashes it based actually on the content of the file. And then, you know, creates e-tags and, you know, does all that, you know, stuff that you're supposed to do for caching purposes. Clearly, the big issue here is that those things cost money, right? And so, you know, what I really wanted to be is I wanted to be the best solution in the OSS, in the OSS space.
So one thing that we went through really quick in passing, and just for anyone that's listening that doesn't know about CSS spriting, can you explain like what that is? And then, you know, technically in CSS, like how you're taking an image reference or an image background and turning that into, you know, how that works in the CSS there.
Sure. Yeah. Good point. So a CSS sprite is basically the ability to take multiple images and essentially turn them into a single image. So the thought being that for every single image, you know, for every single separate physical image, you're going to incur a network round trip of going out there, grabbing it, and there's all sorts of performance ramifications there. So basically the way that technically it works is in your CSS, you have a background property that you can specify an actual image URL, and you can also specify offsets. So you could conceivably have an image, let's say you've got 9 images, all of which are 10 by 10. So you could basically have an image that's 30 by 30, 3 images going across, and then, you know, 3 images across, 3 images down, for a total of 9 images on what typically you call these things sprite sheets. And then in your CSS, what you do is you say the offset. So like your top upper left image, you're going to give that an offset of 0 vertically and 0 horizontally. And then somewhere, you know, you're going to give it a width and height of 30, or at least make sure that based on its, you know, where it falls in the DOM, it's always going to have a width and height of 30. Then on the next one over, and this is a little unintuitive to understand at first, but its horizontal positioning is actually going to be a negative 30. And actually, I might even specify, you don't want it to be a negative 30. You want to have some spacing in between them to account for like zooming in and out. So, it might be a negative, you know, it might be a negative 31. And then its vertical will be 0. And then the next one down, its vertical will be negative 30, and its horizontal will be 0. So basically, it's a way of taking, you know, individual smaller images, joining them together into a single image. So you have one round trip to the server that can serve sometimes. I've seen sprites with 50 images, and that makes total sense if these are, you know, tiny icons. Is that pretty clear?
Yeah, definitely. I know that was one of the things, like we did a lot of optimization on the ASP.NET site recently, and we ended up with, you know, sprites, and I think ours has easily 50 on there.
The great thing about being on a high traffic website, which up until recent, well, I guess I still am, but is that it's a great, you know, testing ground for this stuff. But the other thing is that, and one thing that you quickly learn, that I quickly learned with this, is just how many crazy ways people are using CSS and JavaScript. And so what I would do a lot is I have this test harness where basically I could take any page on the internet and essentially wrap it with, bootstrap it with request reduce. You know, I basically suck down the content and then serve it through request reduce. So actually one of the pages I used to use was the ASP.NET homepage. And I noticed when you made that change, like,
you get pretty deep into like parsing the CSS. I noticed in the source code, it's actually computing like specificity scores. Why is that?
That was some code I spent, in fact, I think, during the holidays, I worked on that code. So one of the big problems that I use, and since I put that out, I have a lot less problems. It's still not 100%, but one of the biggest problems that I have is request reduce basically messing up somebody's page. That's dramatically less, but it's always because of spriting. And the reason why is because there was always some connection that wasn't being made, that for some reason there was bleeding or the offsets were wrong. And one of the things that often played a role in this is when people had a page that was already sprited, or some of their images were sprited and some weren't. And one thing that request reduce can deal with that. So it'll look to see if you have offsets, and we'll try and make the calculations. So what's a typical pattern when you're doing that is to have in your CSS to have your reference to your background image URL in one selector, and then in other selectors to have the actual offsets. So you might have a selector, dot image that has the image URL, and then you might have, dot image dot left that has no image URL. It inherits from dot image, so it gets that URL. In there, it specifies the positioning. So with the specificity selectors, basically what I was trying to do is be able to look at a CSS and be able to travel down, to find the tree if I could, and basically flatten some, multiple selectors. And I was able to, by doing that, I was able to dramatically reduce the amount of mistakes that request reduce could potentially make. There's still some gaps because request reduce can only know what it sees in the CSS. It doesn't actually go out and look at all, the images and, how they fit in the DOM and how they relate to one another. And, there's all sorts of nuances that can go on there. But that's where I was trying to get to with that specific.
That's amazing. You just have no fear.
And the reason you'd need to do that is because you could have one style that applies one background image and then another with a higher CSS specificity that would override that, and you need to account for that then, right?
Exactly. And so like I said, like this test harness that I just talked about, so like, when I would do, experimental stuff like that, I would, I would always go I would pump it through, like pump GitHub through it. I'd pump the ASP.NET website. I'd pump Stack Overflow, Amazon, what are the sites that people go to, and what represents, different ways of, Amazon will put their page together very differently from GitHub. And, I get people, issues like, we have a telerik control and, blah, 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 blah. And, it's amazing, just all the different permutations that, that can have an impact.
And what was the end result? You published some statistics on your blog that were pretty interesting.
Some sites are going to have a dramatic impact. Some might not be so dramatic. So one site that I went live on that I'd say, in the Microsoft family sites that I work on, it definitely had the biggest impact was our blogging platform. So I'm not going to say who. It's not Microsoft. We use a third-party blogging platform, and it's there's a lot of limitations in there that prevent us from being able to go in and do really what we want to do or what we should do. And so before you put request reduce, this is definitely one of those sites where you would just it made horrible use of CSS imports. Just tons of JavaScript. So this is an ASP.NET 2.0 site, which was using a lot of the old, what do you call those guys? The script, they dynamically create, generate the script.
Oh, right. Where you write out, I forget, where you concatenate SCR, IPT, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And those things are just awful for this, because it's a different, script for each one. And so, the beauty of request reduce is that you don't have to touch your site. As long as you can get this thing in your bin file and, adjust your web config, you can take advantage of this. So for that particular site, we saw a 33%, about a 1/3% performance impact. I mean, it was awesome. When I saw the graph the next day, I always try to kind of shield myself from becoming too overly, joyous, I guess. When I saw that, I'm just like, oh, this is awesome. 30%. Now there's other sites, that aren't going to see as much. So like the forum site, for example, it was already doing a lot of the spriting. a lot of its performance issues were more on the server and not so much on the front end. So it really didn't have that much of a boost. I think where request reduce really, you know, comes into play too are just people that, you know, your normal people are just trying to get just a normal site up and don't, you know, care to know about these details, and they can just plug it in. And suddenly, and certainly if you knew stuff, you know, they could probably get even more, but with request reduce, they can get a lot for free.
So I'm tempted to talk more about this, but we haven't even started to talk about Chocolatey.
I definitely want to spend some time on Chocolatey. So I guess, you know, to close on request reduce, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I think, I'm really happy with the fact that now the ASP.NET team actually has a, you know, a first-class product that, you know, I know that they're working on with the beauty of NuGet. You know, they're able to rev on that constantly. Guy I actually used to work with, Howard Durking, you know, great guy. And I've, you know, I think they're doing great work. I think there'll always be a place for request, you know, reduce out there. But I'd actually, now that that stuff is open source, I'd love to take some of the request reduce stuff and find, you know, if there's areas where I can put that, you know, where I can maybe, you know, plug that into ASP.NET. I don't know. Certainly there's the spriting stuff. I believe they're already working on that. And Cassette.NET, also very popular. You know, he's Andrew Davies. He's taken in some of the spriting. But I haven't worked on it much in the last few months because I've been so busy with work and with some other stuff. But I do want people to know that the project is, you know, I know I have a few users that have been asking questions and haven't really been getting answers the way I'd like them to get out. But the project is not dead.
So I mean, your site requestreduce.org, is it? I think. Yeah, I mean, it's got great information on, you know, you can pull it in from NuGet or you can download it, you drop it into your site, and then you add, like you were saying, literally like three lines to your web config, and that's it. Like, it does everything. So, that's like the huge difference. Like, because I talked at length to Howard about what they're doing with the ASP.NET bundling and optimization, and it's really slick, but it has the expectation that you are going to go in and you're going to define bundles and you're going to reference them a certain way. And so you need to develop for it. Whereas what you're doing is you just drop it on a slow site and it's going to work faster.
And there's a case to be made for both of those sides, I think. I think the magic of it kind of scares some people, maybe for good reason. You know, I mean, the nice thing is that it's a little bit more deterministic to do the way that, you know, most other people do it. You know, I mean, and nobody wants to run the risk of, gee, I come to work one day and why are all my, you know, why is my site screwed up? You know, not that that's happened with request reduce, but, you know, I mean, it's a, there's a certain amount of good feelings that, you know, of a build time tool or something where you help give it a little bit more help and you have, you know, you just feel like you know more about how it's happening.
You know, one thing we didn't mention at all yet, we talked about CSS and spriting, but there is one other thing, which is that you pull in less CSS and CoffeeScript.
And that's funny. That actually was pretty easy. And, you know, because I'm basically just piggybacking off of, you know, other open source projects, you know, out there. So, you know, dot less for the less, and then what was it? The SaaS Coffee. Paul Betts is.
Oh right, yeah, SaaS and Coffee, and we had Paul on the show just to talk about that.
In fact, I think he's handed over a lot of that development to a guy. I forget his Nico or. Anyways, good guy. I mean, he was been very responsive to some queries that I had a while back. You know, there was some. I listened to that show that when you had Paul on, and there was some crazy. I mean, it was awesome, and, you know, but some crazy stuff that, you know, he had to do to get that stuff working.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, now I think they're using the IE Chakra, you know, engine, and it's definitely much more stable than it was. But I'm simply just leveraging off of those compilers. So fortunately, those compilers have, you know, exposed endpoints that I can go in. I can just give it stuff, and I don't have to. You know, I do all my own caching, so I don't need it to do all that stuff for me. I just need to be able to feed it the content and get back, you know, real CSS.
Now, one question I had with that, since you are digging script out of pages, you're looking for script begin and end tags. Could I have CoffeeScript and a script tag, and you do that conversion to JavaScript?
Yes, you can. In fact, that's the way it works. So, you have CoffeeScript or SAS or less, you know, it does the compilation. So you have a .coffee file It takes that file, it runs it through the CoffeeScript compiler, and then caches the compiled script and serves that to the user.
Yeah, so what I meant was, and I was not clear about this, but what I meant is a script type equals coffee or, you know, whatever, and then some CoffeeScript code and then a closed script. And I'm guessing you don't do that, but it seems like it's maybe technically possible because you're of the way that you're working.
It is, yeah. So one thing the request, I mean, yeah, it is. It's technically possible, but request reduce currently doesn't process inline script.
That's one of my core values in interviewing people is to find one completely ridiculous, worthless feature no one would ever use and pinpoint. I narrow in right on that one.
Yeah.
So let's move on to Chocolaty and Box Starter.
So it's funny, you know, that so a lot of the principles that go into, you know, Box Starter, Chocolaty, you know, kind of are shared with Request Reduce. You know, I'm really in. So one of the things I'm really passionate about is reducing developer friction. You know, developers don't want to be scripting images. You know, at least most don't want to. They don't want to be, you know, making sure their stuff is minified. You know, they want to be adding value. They want to be adding features. So on the same end, when it comes to building an environment or building a box, I don't have to spend a day and little. I mean, usually, I mean, let's be honest. You know, as a developer, when you have to repave your machine and you know, assuming that you don't have any kind of tooling, you could be talking a day. You know, right? I mean, maybe more. Now, Visual Studio, the new version of Visual Studio, I will say, is much better. God, I remember, you know, back in 2000. And then you have to, like, look at the models, you know, with the awkward poses, you know, as
the guy with the weird nose or the weird eyes. I think it was the weird eyes.
Tell, like, yeah. And he was just kind of looking at you kind of creepy and you just didn't, yeah. But you had to look at it because you wanted to get work done and you had to be there to click the next button or the restart button. So this, I'm trying to think how this all got started. I think it was actually got started just by my home computers. Like, and you know, as we've been revving up, you know, with Windows 8 and all that stuff, and I've been trying to get the, you know, the newest bits on my machine, I've been doing a lot of repaving. And I can't tell you how many times at work where you hit that kind of conclusion, you know what, I've got to do this. And you just put it off because it's like, oh gosh, you know, I don't want to, you know, not today or not tomorrow, you know, I'll get to it next week. So I just want it to be a non-event. I want it to be repeatable. And so what a lot of people have done, what I see happen a lot to address this is VM. So VM is like the next step, right? So I see a lot of work for developers working, you know, doing like their full-time work out of a VM. And that just doesn't feel, I don't like that for a few reasons. One is it just doesn't feel natural. There's a performance cost and you're moving in one environment out of another environment. And then two, you have to make sure to keep that VM up to date. And it's just too easy to like get just a bunch of junk on that VM. And before you know it, you've got to blow away the VM, and the VM that you had saved is missing a whole bunch of stuff. And now you got to go off and get that stuff. Then you got to store these VMs somewhere, and they're not small. So I started looking at just ways in which I could automate, you know, this stuff. You know, just you know, so now we've got PowerShell, which is just, you know, awesome for this. And so this was a combination of stuff that I was doing at home and stuff I was doing at work. So I'm no longer part of this org, but at the time I was part of the what most people think of as the MSDN TechNet org. And you know, so we're constantly having to build new test environments and staging environments, and we really didn't have a good automated solution for that. And a lot of that stuff was offloaded to vendors that, you know, they just kind of, they followed a kind of a script of instructions, and then honestly, you know, so the script of instructions was like 50 pages of, you know, now click next, now take this folder and copy it over to this folder, and these were scripts for, you know, just setting up new environments, and inevitably things would be wrong. And in my opinion, if you've got a 50-page script and you have 5 mistakes, you should get like a trophy and say, you know, congratulations, you know, you only made 5 mistakes. That's, you know, good for
right.
you. But there's no reason why. So it just occurred to me, there's no reason why any of this stuff can't be done. And so in a previous life, I had set up this whole thing. I use cruise control and Nant and basically had this whole continuous, you know, integration deployment thing that it would just do this stuff. And so actually, I'm getting a little off subject because Chocolaty is not so much for, though it can be for deployments. But I really, you know, so my vision was I wanted to be able to walk up to a box and enter in one line of PowerShell that I could reliably remember, and then walk back. Maybe, you know, there's several scenarios. One might be 2 hours later and have a fully built machine, or one might be just sit there for 2 minutes, you know, while, because I might just be going, you know, terminal servicing to some computer. I just want my favorite text editor and, you know, a few little utilities that I always want. And I don't want to be able to have to carry stuff around. I want to just be able to, you know, pull up, you know, a command line that every single, you know, computer should have, type in a line of script, and then be done with it. So that's the vision. So I quickly discovered, well, I had discovered Chocolaty actually a while back, and you know, I've mentioned this a couple times. I really, at the time, I just didn't really quite get the ramifications of it, but suddenly I discovered when I was going through this, like, this is really cool. I can, first of all, if you go to the Chocolaty site, so http://chocolaty.org, and I always want to call it Chocolaty, you know, and for the longest time, you know, I hadn't actually heard it until I heard like Rob Reynolds, you know, I often wonder like if he gets tempted to call it. I've never asked him. I should ask him, like, you ever want to call it Chocolaty, you know, or like get like a commercial with like a sexy, like, you know, Mexican, you know, Latin guy, you know, call it Chocolaty. Anyways, so anyways, because my coworkers tease me because I call it that sometimes, but by mistake. But anyways, so with Chocolaty, you can do that. You can string it. So it just sits on top of NuGet. So it gets all that packaging goodness from NuGet, you know, with dependencies and all of that. But what was missing from, or what I felt was missing from Chocolaty, you could bake this in, but missing in an easy way, was a lot of kind of small little customizations that I like making to my box. So Chocolaty is great for going out there, grabbing software, getting it on your box. And that's a big part of building up a box. Another part is like, just, you know, like I like to sync my personal file on SkyDrive, which means I have to do, you know, I have to move my personal file to SkyDrive. I like having certain icons in my, you know, or links in my taskbar. I like having my taskbar thin.
So I really like what you're saying right now, because there's always, whenever I set up Windows, like there's the install everything, and then there's the I'm not an idiot settings, where you have to go in and show hidden files and, you know, show me the file extensions and all that kind of stuff.
Wait, see, if you're on a server brand, you know, there's the whole, what do you call it? You know, the IE security stuff that's just totally annoying.
Right.
And, you know, the thing that bones me out is now on Windows 8, you basically have to have UAC turned on for Metro apps to work. But anyways, so I want to be able to have all that stuff, you know, in there, you know, certain things, my path. So with Chocolaty, I mean, when it comes down to it, you can do anything. I mean, it's just a PowerShell script file. You know, Chocolaty provides a lot of helper functions that just make things easier for you. So one thing that I've been doing lately is I've been adding some code that makes some of that stuff easier. So like, Rob had already had a function for making desktop links. So I added a function for making taskbar links, some functions for making associating. So like, I like to associate all my DLLs with .peek, for instance. I mean, why else do you, when you click on a DLL, you know, you don't expect really anything to happen. So I like, you know, to have, you know, .peek come up and you know, bring that, you know, bring the insides of a DLL up. So I started this thing called Box Starter on CodePlex. And originally I was thinking, you know, I'm going to leverage a lot of the technology of Chocolaty. I'll basically wrap Chocolaty, but I'll kind of, you know, add in a lot of these, you know, these Windows tweaks and also add in a, you know, so the other thing is the bootstrapper. So now Chocolaty actually has a pretty good bootstrapping story. If you go to the homepage of Chocolaty.org, I mean, it's right there on the front page, is like one line of PowerShell. It's not even power. I mean, you can paste that into just a normal command prompt, hit enter, and it'll handle, you know, even if you're not running as admin, and it'll get all that stuff up and running. The problem is that, I don't know, I guess I'm kind of anal about this, and I don't want to have to take the extra step, you know, even though most machines do have a browser on them, you know, I don't want to have to go to chocolaty.org and copy that. I want to be able to type in something that I can remember.
What's funny, Matt, actually, what prompted me to get in touch with you, because I've had it on a list of get in touch with Matt. But recently, I was this past weekend, I was chatting with with Rob Reynolds, and I was saying, like, hey, you should have an installer. And I know it's one line, but it's still enough that enough people, I know people listening to this podcast right now, you, I'm talking to you, have not installed Chocolaty, because it's like, oh, I got to paste this in. I don't know what it's going to do. And that seems hard, you know. It's like, whereas if it's like a click a button and it's on your computer, that's a lot easier.
You know, I mean, like you say, you know, and I felt, you know, I remember when I first mentioned this to Rob, I felt just like, you know, I just, am I being, you know, just overly tight about this? But yeah, I mean, so obviously, you know, so you have it too. And the other thing is I want to be able to do it multiple times. I want to be able to be on a computer and just, you know, and just go. So I've kind of got my initial approach is basically I have something like BoxStarter. So if you pull down BoxStarter, you know, you could put it on like a thumb drive and I can do, you know, let's say the thumb is on the G drive. So I could do, you know, G:\, you know, BoxStarter/, you know, BoxStarter.bat, and or leave out the .bat if you want, space, and let's say work. So right now, what BoxStarter will do, it has two modes. One, the first thing it'll do is it'll look to see if there's a directory just within BoxStarter called build packages. And so if with work, it'll just basically look for a work.whatever.newpeg file, and then it'll just grab that. If it doesn't see that, it'll go off to myget.org. And so for people that don't know what myget.org is, it's essentially a place where you can host your own NuGet feeds. So, you know, you can host your feed on, you know, NuGet.org itself or on Chocolaty.org or, you know, on your own system. But what's nice is that, you know, there might be, like, for example, my work. So I do have one called work, and I mean, it is public. There's nothing in there that I wouldn't want people to see, but it's nothing that I feel like should clog up the Chocolaty feed. You know, it has how I want my workstation at work. It has a bunch of work specific stuff and, you know, set up, and good chances are that nobody else would want their system set up just like that. But my gets real, you know, it's free. They do have pay plans, but for this, you know, I just have a single feed. You know, it's free, and it's, you know, it's in the cloud, so I don't have to make sure that this package is, you know, somewhere that I can that I can get to. So that's where it's at right now. You know, I can remember those. You know, if I have it, you know, handy, you know, it's always on my desktop. So if I need to read, you know, and this is great for VMs too. So if I need to, because I do have to deal with VMs sometimes for various reasons. If I need to repave a VM, I have a package for that. And from my VM, I can always access this drive. But what I really like to get to, and I'm going to, first of all, I just want to admit to a little bit of ignorance here. I have never created a one-click app, it seems like this would be possible to do, is to have a one-click app that then, you know, assuming that that IE, because I think this will only work on IE, is that IE is associated with URLs on your machine. You should be able to go to a PowerShell prompt and just type in start space an URL to the one-click app, which could be, you know, a friendly URL, and maybe one of the segments of that URL might be the package name itself. So this has two nice things. One is it's just one, yet, you know, one fewer steps. And I don't have to worry about carrying BoxStarter around anywhere. I can actually, you know, it can just be out there. I just have to remember, HTTP, you know, whatever the domain is, WAC, Bootstrapper or whatever, and the package name. Two is, what's also cool is, you know, a lot of times I'll share links. So one thing that I did is I put most of the Visual Studio SKUs, created Chocolaty packages out of them. So if you want to install Visual Studio without any restarts, or, you know, if you want to be able to walk away. So I was giving out links. So, you know, the other day with the Visual Studio launch day, I gave out a link. You know, if you want to get on Chocolaty, so you really have two links, right? You have to go to Chocolaty, and then I've got the link for the package, or the little, you know, cinced Visual Studio thing. Well, wouldn't it be awesome if you just give out a link that basically went straight to the one click? And then also down, you know, it could see, you know, that one click might see, oh, you already have Chocolaty and do nothing as far as Chocolaty installation, but then pull down that package. So then you could, it'd be easier to share links. You know, again, there's some limitations with that. I mean, I do know that with one click, I'm pretty sure it only works on IE.
Yeah. So there was the thing, there's a, it does work on IE. And then there was the click once thing for Firefox was disabled for a bit and is back in, but basically, yeah, it always works on IE.
But still, you know, I think that does improve the story. And so if you take that even further, like what I really see, like, so when we talk about all these Windows tweaks that you can make, what if you could go to a website? So ideally, I'd want my, I think my mom is a stretch, but I'd want somebody that doesn't necessarily know a single thing about PowerShell to be able to go to a website and basically almost like a shopping list, say, you know, Nine-Eyes kind of like this, but, you know, it has very limited functionality in term or selection, but be able to click off, these are all the apps I want, and, you know, install all the critical updates on my computer, you know, make, you know, associate these file types, you know, I want these, you know, start links, put this stuff in my path, you know, just a bunch of little kind of personalized tweaks.
You know, one thing I saw that you committed very recently to Chocolaty was the integration with Windows features. So they've been adding things over time. Like, first of all, it was just it could pull down an EXE or a zip and install. And then later they added in that it could pull down something from NuGet, from a NuGet feed. And so things have been coming in over time. But that's a really slick, and it completely makes sense with what you're saying, to have something in Chocolaty feed that's essentially turning a Windows feature on and off, like IIS or, you know, .NET framework or whatever it is.
Right. Yeah. Anything. And the great thing is that it sits on your computer. So it only tell you, you know, you can do a C list there too. And it'll only tell you what's on your, you know, what you can, your personal computer can pull down. So what I've been devoting some of my time over the last several weeks is basically so I had all this code in Boxstarter. I began to think, you know, this doesn't feel right. You know, Rob's put a lot of work to Chocolaty. Chocolaty's cool. I want people to use, you know, to Chocolaty. You know, so in my opinion, I just think Chocolaty is awesome, and the word just needs to get out. And I mean, who doesn't want a solution that'll just build your box, you know, and then you can go? I mean, it's such a painful process.
And, you know, what you were saying earlier about Nine-Eyes, I mean, I've been going back and forth, and I've rebuilt several computers several times over the past year. Hooray for, you know, crashing SSDs and just, you know, wanting to run the latest Windows 8 and all that. And I like Chocolaty, but it hasn't been quite there. And so I end up using NuGet or using Nine-Eyes and Chocolaty and a lot of other kind of custom stuff. So what you're saying would essentially allow me to say, when I build a new computer, this is how I want it to work, and I'm done.
And your definition of what you want to work, it's not this huge VM. It's actually a very small script file. And, like, there's all sorts of, I mean, the possibilities are endless, right? I mean, like, right now, like, it takes 2 hours. But there's nothing really fancy going on. So, like, you could literally, you know, you could parse out the dependency tree and start multi-threading, you know, so that you could, you know, pull down, you know, 5-10 things at once, and but have another thread that installs them, so that you install them one at a time, but you actually download them en masse. And I'm pretty sure you could dramatically increase the install times by doing it that way. You could there's just all, so basically what, you know, I talked to Rob offline, and so he mentioned, you know, we kind of shot back and forth some ideas. And so the idea being, and I've pretty much finished up the phase where I took all of the code from Boxstarter that I felt like was just a good fit for Chocolaty and put that in there. And there's some other code that doesn't really, you know, like, because I have code that I'll just do, like, install Windows updates. Like, that might not necessarily be a good fit natively for Chocolaty, but it might be a great Chocolaty package. So I'm going to take kind of some of that stuff and make them separate packages, and then take, like, the actual bootstrapping stuff, and we'll probably put this under the Chocolaty org and call it, like, you know, Chocolaty Bootstrapper. That'll be where that'll go.
It took me a while to get why Chocolaty was useful. And then the bigger thing I started realizing is the whole dependency management. So I could have a, you know, you can group things together and you can say, you know, johngalloway.devtools and johngalloway.blah, blah, blah. And like you're saying, put it on a private feed or whatever, or not, you know, like Alan Stevens has his out on Chocolaty. It's like Alan Stevens' favorite utilities, you know, and then you can group them all together into a, you know, John Galloway build box, and, you know, and it'll go through and it'll just refer to 4 Chocolaty packages, which will refer to, you know, all the tree underneath them.
A great example of that is so at work, I work for the TFS org, and part of our org is working on, you know, put out this tool called GitTF. It's very much like GitTFS, but it's cross-platform, so it's built off of Java. A lot of people don't know this, but there's a lot of work that goes into like the Eclipse integration for TFS. So they have a team of Java developers there. So they basically they created this thing. But the thing, you know, so the to use it, you have to bring down the JD, you know, the Java runtime. You have to bring down Git, and you have to bring down Git TF, and you have to set paths and another environment variable. And so I was able to create a chocolatey package, and because I work for the org, I was able to actually go into their Maven script and basically make it so that whenever they pump out a build, it just pumps out a new chocolatey package for them. And it's just one more thing that you can get wrong, right, with installing if it's a JDK or the JD run, the Java runtime and stuff like that. And the other thing that you mentioned about people will put their stuff on GitHub. Now, I think one of the biggest problems that needs to be solved with chocolatey is the fact that a lot of times people go to chocolatey and they'll get 404s because, people haven't kept up the package. Because people are keeping this stuff on GitHub, what I'll do a lot of times is if that happens to me, either it's got a 404, it doesn't work at all, or it's old, you just go to GitHub and send them a pull request. So it's nice, but that's actually amazing. I hear that from a lot of people. Oh yeah, the chocolatey and. This stuff, it wasn't available or, it was broken or whatever. I mean, I by far positive, and I'm sure tons of ways to address that, but that.
So that's one important distinction is that, like for NuGet, everything is on the feed. They host all the binaries. When you upload something to NuGet, it's a NuGet package that has everything there. And then you could disappear from the face of the earth and delete all your repositories before doing so, and nothing changes. But like you're saying, for chocolatey is essentially just a PowerShell script. Doesn't hold any binaries, and the PowerShell script just says go to this URL and pull this thing down and install it most of the time.
Yeah, most of the time, right? Like with NuGet, I mean, you can actually put in custom PowerShell scripts. So you can do anything you want there. And with chocolatey, I've seen there are times where I've seen people actually put in embed the executables, especially like with like some one click stuff. I think I did that with the NuGet Explorer, but that's a pretty small executable, and it's definitely not the norm. But yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's very easy for that stuff to go quickly stale.
So it's been a little bit over an hour. We should probably wrap up. Are there other things that we've missed that you'd like to touch on?
I guess try download chocolatey and check it out. If you don't like rebuilding a machine and would like to explore ways to make that faster, check out chocolatey. Check out the documentation. Let us know. There's a whole Google groups. Let us know if there's pain points. It's actively watched, and the people behind that want nothing more than to make it a fantastic product. And Request Reduce is not dead. I'm still working on it. But time, unfortunately, I have realized is finite.
So to put the marketing spin on it, I mean, this is something that's actively used on some high volume websites right now, right? Request Reduces.
Requests, definitely put that out there. I do take, I have taken pull requests. I haven't gotten many recently, but if, I do get, some people will complain a lot about a certain thing. And, usually it's because that certain thing is a real difficult to fix. And I don't, if it was easy, I would have fixed it. But if you want to take things on as a pull, I'm happy to review them over and bring them on. I'm hoping to blog some more too. It's something I really enjoy, but it's like given the choice of do I code this or do I blog this, usually the coding wins.
I absolutely hear you, but I have appreciated your blog. There's a lot of great information there.
Thanks.
All right, one last thing before we wrap. You said you're on the TFS team, and we just recently talked to David Starr. Is there anything interesting you'd like to mention about what you're doing on the TFS team?
So I'm working on the team that I work for is work item tracking, and I'll be straight up about this. Historically, I haven't been the biggest fan of the product, but mainly in terms of source control. So I'm a weird Microsoft employee in that I started out, when I moved here, I came from SVN. The group I was on that I joined was using Mercurial. And it wasn't until recently that I've had to touch TFS. And so I kind of had this mindset, well, if I'm going to have to, you know, work with TFS, I'd kind of like to be on the team. And a lot of this will come out eventually, but there's some pretty cool stuff that's actually going on. I'm not at liberty to talk about it, but I think when it comes out, it's going to be pretty awesome. And the work item tracking is that if you haven't looked at the work item tracking since VS 2012 came out, it's dramatically better. I was actually, you know, I love GitHub. I love the simplicity of, you know, GitHub and CodePlex. But that's a real effort that we're trying to make on TFS is simplicity. So we have this whole motto. Brian Harry has this principle of, in fact, I actually might even go further than Brian Harry. I might be Soma, but of raving fans. And the whole point is to, you know, yes, I mean, we've got the enterprise nailed down. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're all developers. And as I've said before, I'm a huge, you know, to me, it's huge to in any way to reduce the friction. And so we're really looking at areas where we can do that. So I know, you know, there's plenty of, you know, things to be said about TFS, but I, you know, please feel free to email me on Twitter. I'm mrockx, mrockx. And I would be interested in hearing, you know, what, you know, so I do personally work on the work item tracking, and you know, I'm going to be working on REST interfaces. It's going to be one of my big thing to do. So in particular, I'm interested, like, what are people interested in our REST API for TFS? I mean, we're determined to bring a first class REST API, which we clearly do not have right now. And what are the use cases? What are the pain points? You know, be blunt, be honest. I want to hear it.
Great. Well, on that note, let's wrap up. So thanks a bunch, Matt. It's been great talking to you.
And thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Matt.
All right, and catch us at a... I'm going to follow Kay Scott's recent thing. Catch us at a future date for another unspecified Herding Code.